the session to be recorded and broadcasted, so you could use any microphones and state your name and affiliation when asking any questions. Just before we get started, there is a slight feeling amongst the chairs that the agenda has been a bit light for the last couple of meetings. Like I said, we've got some different candidates who are hopefully going to present on the measuring efforts that they're doing. We're a little aware that the charter may suggest that you have to be using the right TTM system to be able to do presentations here, and we'd like to encourage presentations that are more about internet measurement. Whether we do this through a change to the charter isn't clear, but it's just a follow-up that we're actually thinking about widening the scope of the group a little bit later, and we'd welcome any input. One thing I forgot to do is the minutes of the last meeting in Dubai accepted. Were there any issues with them? Okay. Should we start straight away with Ruben?
Good morning. Thank you for making town this early hour. My name is Ruben Staven at Bank NCC. I work at the Information Services Department and I'm the Service Manager for Test Traffic Measurements. And this is my update. The status of the grid, as I would like to call it, we have 106 boxes listed. And of which is 78 active, which is 74%. The number of installations we get since last update, that's to complete a case, which means that a computer server and six antenna kits where the household provider own a computer server. So there's an increasing popularity in just kind of the kits and get your own hardware, which is good, which is encourages to roll out. The new boxes are internal one for IPC for SLA measurements and two for the Chinese University of in Hong Kong, which is in Hong Kong, which kind of large presence in the Far East. Replacements we had mentioned here last updates. And the information boxes, but we also known since the last updates, so it's stable. The current running projects we have is TTM in Brazil. This week, I checked the algorithm, and there's indeed still one to go. They are planning this to provide a very large carrier in Brazil. I'll probably get back to them in about a month time to see what the status about that. TTM in the Equinix area. Last year we shipped a bunch of club cards to Brisbane. They provisioned the cables and the antennas themselves, and then they send it off to locations in their service area. It's active, but it's currently rolled out. Also, some new efforts in that area. We're planning to do the same thing in the Red Band area, so that's the former Soviet Union. And a new effort in the Electronic area, which is a bit different from the current effort running in Brazil, as this will be for the whole Electronic area, as well as just Brazil. Both of those are just be on the discussion. Then the new installs, that's really a large list. First of all, really different locations where we briefly used to be, like Europe and the United States. And obviously, that we start to pop up in locations in Africa, like in Nairobi and Pretoria. There's a pending installation for preserve many boxes for decades. There's another additional one for every measurement at the exchange. And one that is going to be placed at Nixie in Delhi in India. The graphs, so this actually shows some graphs. As you see, it's quite stable. At the end of January, we had a kind of a dip in the service delivery of TTL. We pushed this away by the mid-March, so to say. You also see that there's a slight increase in the historic buffers, but those were already confirmed to be out of service last year. So those are now new additions to that. What else has been cooking since then? At Web Entity, we have a process that's called ITSCMO, which stands for the IT service capability measuring model. It's all about service delivery, change management. It has five levels. Currently, we deploy the build level to win right by entity with various bits and parts of the service level, I believe. The team is part of this since quarter 2009. We make monthly reports that go to senior management, and we list the key and specific performance indicators. The key performance indicators are like what was the availability of the service, the number of opened and closed troubleshooting tickets. And for the specific ones which are like specific for the service, it's the availability of the greatest number I have showed you in the first slide. So can you report it on a monthly basis? And also the speed of data delivery. We aim for delivery within one day. Something else, well, but what we see with the rollout of TKM becoming more and more places. And also being used for other services like D and so on. We often see that users of the service have questions like why is this bar red and why is this not showing lots of loss or lots of delay. And they ask us, can you figure out at the other side what's going on? And yeah, it's based on the messenger. And the thing is, do we actually need additional troubleshooting tools, or do we even need some sort of a collaboration platform in where we can bring the users of the service together so they can directly or indirectly ask questions to the owners of the books? But yeah, this all needs discussions which I hope can be done in test traffic working group, but because it needs your input. And that brings me to the questions to the slides. Are there any?
I don't know how to that's speaking as myself this time. We go back to the previous slides. Get in touch with each other. The original plan was that this working group would be the place to get in touch with each other. And we also have two mailing lists, one for everybody, the TV working group list for everybody who's interested in measurements in general, and the TTL's list, which is was intended as a list for testbox hosts to communicate amongst each other. So all these things are still there, but I think that there is still very little traffic on it.
Yeah, it might be that it's kind of forgotten, and that people think that's only about discussion about the service in some sort of meta fashion and not like the day-to-day operational
there's something that happens is you're going to send a refresh message to the list and remind the people that need this.
Yeah, I guess we can cover it that way. Yes, of course, there's input from the other Postbox owners or the desk traffic working group, but another platform is being designed in there. But yeah, this is good to start and to bring this to the attention of the owners and users of the service and see if this works.
Is a mailing the right form of doing this? Somebody needs something at all. And a collaborative tool based on websites. Yes, we can hear you. You're breaking up with the touch.
slides in the fifth over here. Switch to the slides. Try switching video off your side, please. Okay. I'm sorry, I'm having some, as you can see, we're having some problems with the audio on this. Would it be a good idea to move on to Tony's presentations and come back to this? So I told you a few minutes here. Second. Andrew, can you hear us? To get to the comments we're having over the remote participation. Move on to the next presenter, which is Tony McGregor, who's a visiting researcher in the NTC, and he's going to give a talk, give 30 talks, first one on Bill Tree. Okay. packing, and buying, as you said, has been for OpenCC for 5 months. And the main project that I'm working on is the looking at the design and what the requirements would be for a large scale active measurement system, perhaps with in the order of 100,000 probes at least in the design. And as part of that, the notion of using DoubleTree for optimizing tracer has come up, and it was suggested that you might find it interesting to learn a little bit about DoubleTree. It's an idea that was presented in a paper a couple of years ago. Now, it's got nothing to do with me in terms of the development of it. I just happen to be looking into it, so I'm going to present the idea to you. I'm going to start by teaching you to suck eggs. I just want to start by talking a little bit about TraceRoute, and I realise almost all of you probably know about TraceRoute, but it just gives a starting point to work from, and I personally find it frustrating when I go to talks and I don't understand anything, so you'll probably understand all of this talk. So TraceRoute, as you know, works by sending out packets with limited TTL, so usually starting with one, and then the packet times out, and the node sends back a ICMP TTL expired message, and then you increment the TTL, and of course you work out effectively what the path is. Of course, it's a little bit more complicated than that. It doesn't really tell you about the nodes, it tells you about interfaces. So you get back a message saying what interface, usually the incoming interface to a router. Of course, it's a little bit more complicated still. In fact, TraceRoute only sends multiple packets to each hop 3 is the common case. And even that's not really true because you have different paths in each direction. And of course, TraceRoute points the forward path, it can't find the backward path, which is obviously important. It's also true that from the intermediate hops, perhaps from this one here, the path back that the TTL expired packet takes might have nothing to do with this, or the forward or the reverse path, right? So the path back from here to there won't go through F, it doesn't necessarily go through B, it could go somewhere else entirely. This is why sometimes in a trace route you see lines that don't make sense. Ethan, I think, on this presentation gave a classic example of that. You know, his first few hops were sort of 75, 80, 95, then 200-odd milliseconds, and then back to 90, and so forth. And one of the reasons why that happens is because of this reverse path problem. Actually, there's a whole lot more issues with TraceRoute. Of course, sometimes you get RFC 1018 addresses appearing because that's what the router interface was configured with. Lots of times, you don't get an answer back at all. ICMP might have been disabled somewhere, or perhaps a router with a filter for ICMP that's less common now than it first was. You can get false routes that don't exist at all. Just imagine this is two forward paths with perhaps a load balancer in the middle here. You might start going this way, and then the next hop might go in a different direction, and it appears that there's a link from C to G, which doesn't exist in reality. You have to deal with this issue that you're getting interfaces not locked, routers, and if that matters to you, you've got to somehow figure out what interfaces are all on one router, and that's quite tricky to do. Sometimes hops exist that don't decrement TTL at all. And of course, there are tunnels with different varieties, and you may or may not discover things in there. So, one of the problems with TraceRoute is if you are traceroute from some sources, more than one, to a large number of destinations, which is what a number of projects do, including TTM, of course, you wait for low effort. And this is what DoubleTree is designed to deal with. It's designed to reduce the amount of effort that you waste in probing. So I'm just going to go through a couple of quick examples. We've got two different sources here. I'm just going to focus on the first one to start with, and two different destinations. Obviously, a trivial case that you can imagine the situation where there are perhaps thousands of these things. And trace throughout, if you're tracing just from yes to the moment to these two things, you go out a hop at a time, and you find that one, and then you go out a hop at a time, and you find the other one. Oops, and the first hops on this path are probed twice in two different sets of trace routes, one when you're trace running up to D, and the other one when you're tracing up to A2. And what that one tree says is, well, that's a bit of a wasted effort. Let's see if we can reduce that. And so DoubleTree keeps, for this part of the redundancy, it keeps a stop set, a local stop set. So the module when it's probing, it just remembers what hops it's seen. So if we're sort of halfway through, we've just probed out to D. So we've already seen, of course, the source in A and B and C and D. And so we've brought those in a stop set. And then when we start probing, instead of probing from the beginning, we pick some point in the middle of the network. Perhaps in theory, it might be better to sort of start from the absolute destination, but of course you don't know how far away that is. And as we'll see, there's another optimization that TraceRoute does that. But there's the fact that if you started from the very end, if you could. And so you pick a number somewhere in the middle, and there's some discussion in the paper of how you go about picking that number. And you do your first GTL probe out to there. So, of course, it's gone through these links, but it discovers E. And so you add E to the stop set, and then you probe again with one less for the GTL. So now we've probed out to D, and you put that in for the local stop set, and of course, now you get to B. And D was already in the stop set, and so you don't need to probe anymore because you know what the path is from S1 to B. There's also, and then you've got to finish the process, of course, so you start probing upwards from where you started until you get to the destination. So, in the paper, they do some analysis of how much redundancy is going on, and they produce these graphs. These are like box and whisker type graphs, just slightly differently drawn. So, this is the minimum, the lower quartile, the median, the upper quartile, and the maximum up here. And the really important thing to notice is the logarithmic scale, and this is how many hops away you are from the source monitor. And on this one, we're looking at the redundancy, how much redundancy there is in terms of an absolute number. And this experiment, they took a topology from CADA's. This one was scattered, and they took just 50,000 destinations out of it just to reduce the amount of work in simulating. And they found that it was in the order of 150,000 redundant probes at the beginning of the path, basically. Pretty much everything you're doing is redundant. And the further away from the beginning of the path you go, the lower the median goes, which kind of is logical and makes sense. In fact, everything about DoubleTree is logical and makes sense, and it's obviously just a good idea. With DoubleTree, that's reduced dramatically in the order of 150 redundant probes per hop at the beginning of the network, and then going dropping off rapidly as well. You might wonder why there are any redundant hops at the beginning, probes for DoubleTree at the beginning, but of course, you've got to take account of the concurrent nature of this kind of probing, so you don't instantly, you don't do one trace and then that gets into your stop set, and then you do the next one. There's concurrent probes going on, so sometimes you end up with, you still end up with some redundant probing, but not as much. So the other half, I just told you really about half of DoubleTree, the other half of DoubleTree deals with the fact that you are probing from different sources to the same destinations. And so the same kind of redundancy happens, just rooted at the other end. So imagine that we've traced out from source 1 to destination 1 to destination 2, using DoubleTree probably. And then now we're going from source 2 out to destination 2. And of course, there's a common couple of hops in here, and we don't really need to keep on retracing those either. And so we build a global stop set. One that's shared between the monitors. And if we were at our initial stage here, and the global stop set. Well, we've seen that we've seen destination one and we've seen A, B, and C in that path, and destination two, we've seen A, B, D, and E, and we start probing again from, we're going to start from S1 here. In this case, if we're probing forwards from S1, as soon as we get to D, in fact, we discover, well, we don't need to go any further because we've already traced all that. We've seen a node D on the way to D2, so now global stop set, and so we stop. And so that's what's called double tree because it looks at the trees from both ends. The intermonitor redundancy is in the examples that they look at in the paper, which is for a relatively small number of sources to a large number of destinations, which matches most topology discovery systems today. There's a lot less gain from the intermonitor redundancy. It's not logarithmic this time on the scale. But we're only looking at sort of in the order of 25 redundant probes at a peak. There's a peak at a large number, and that's just because some of the paths will finish. So this might be the end of a certain number of paths, like at whatever that is, 15 or so. So close to the source, of course, there's not much redundancy. It goes up and then just drops off as a number of paths. And in the order of 25 peaking there, whereas for the median at least, with double tree, yeah, it takes a much longer level during that time. So that's basically double tree. Does anyone can track the time?
Given our problems with the previous speaker, I think we should have plenty of time.
I don't want to take more time, more of your time than this really warrants, sorry, let me just talk briefly about the limitations of double tree and the application that we're going to use for it. And then I've got another trace route technology to talk about, so perhaps I will do that if there's no worry about the time. So double tree finds fewer nodes. So there's some limitations to double tree. It finds fewer nodes than repeated trace routes. So what they did in the paper was they just added up how many interfaces were reported by double tree and how many interfaces were reported by trace route. And double tree finds less because it's not repeatedly probing, and of course the network isn't static. The topology might change during the time of the probing, and so you might discover some new probes with trace route that you wouldn't find with double tree. There could be load balancing, which is, I'm going to talk a bit about that in a moment. And so it's kind of a mixed message really as to whether this is a bad thing or not. Because finding new nodes may actually just confuse the situation rather than, because something's changed, it might be better to sort of get a more static picture of the network. It depends on what your motivation for measurement is. And the other big issue is that the global stop set requires communication. Monitors need to tell one another what they've already found, and of course that reduces to some extent its effectiveness. How much it reduces, it depends a bit on how many monitors you've got and how much redundancy they discover. So the other project I'm going to tell you about, the thing that I'm working on here, as I mentioned at the beginning, is this large-scale active measurement system, which is called Diverse Aspect Resource Data. And it's one of the issues that comes up in there is, well, we might have actually many sources, and we might want to investigate just a few destinations because we found out that there's something about those destinations we want to know that's not reachable from everywhere in the internet. And so in this case, we're sort of turning around the current work that's been done with most internet topology measurement systems. And we're going from a large number of sources to a small number of destinations, and it seems that double tree could be very effective for reducing the amount of work that happens. You can't just, say you had 100,000 probes in the network and you discovered that some people couldn't get to your network. And you want to see exactly how. You can't just send 100,000 trace routes to that one box that you've got in your network, obviously, because it's going to overwhelm the the sore spots. But DoubleTree might well be able to reduce that very significantly in its infant monitor into Pro pipe working. But on the other side, there's this issue of sharing the upset, which could reduce the usefulness of it. And so, what I'm doing at the moment with DoubleTree is I built a simulator to just finish it this week to study this issue. Basically, I want to find out how effective DoubleTree is with a large number of sources, a small number of destinations, and what the cost is there and the stop set is, and how you can perhaps optimize that. So the other sort of general trace route technology that I thought I'd mention just briefly is this thing called Paris trace route. Again, not my work, but references there. And it's looking at the issue of discovering load balances. They cited another study that was done in 2006 that had just 5,000 destination addresses, but out of 5,000 had reasonably good coverage of the sort of core of the internet. Well, it's 7 out of 9 tier 1 ISPs, this is their figures out of the paper. But the important thing is that they were very keen that there were about 80% of destinations had a load balancer somewhere in their path. This is kind of being one monitor to, so it's not having an exhaustive study that you'd put a great deal of confidence on the number, but it's probably in the ballpark. So load balancers can be a bit of a problem for trace route, as I mentioned before. So imagine we have a load balancer A somehow dividing the traffic between C and B, and we go out and we do our trace route, and we get to there, we get to here, and then for some reason, and I'll come back to what the reasons might be, the load balancer decides to send our next pack out through this other path. We then continue perhaps with the same thing, and we've discovered this topology that doesn't even exist. We haven't discovered there's a load balancer, and we have discovered something that it doesn't exist, which is, what's the point if we can't discover even a valid path as it falls down? There are other ways this might work out. So in this case, we've gone to A, and then to C, and then to E, and then the path has changed, and we've taken this longer one, so we get E twice, and it looks like we've got a loop in the path. And so we can also get diamonds, a diamond would be what we actually want to see here because of the load balancer. So it turns out that there are really three ways that load balancers work. They can be random, just any old pack that they decide to send on one link or the other. Not many load balancers do that because it's going to introduce jitter and perhaps reordering into a stream of packets. So they don't do that very often. Some load balancers are destination based, so they just look at the destination field in the IP panel and just say, all of one destination they'll send in one direction, and all of another destination they may send in a different direction. And destination based is kind of a special case of flow ID based load balancing. And flow ID load balancers try to make a decision about or try to keep all packets from one flow together. The definition of a flow for load balancers varies. Some of them use the classic five tuple source IP and destination IP, source and destination port and IP protocol. Others included some TOS data in there. In the case of ICMP packets, they often include the code and checksum out of the ICMP packet. And that seems a bit odd, but I'll come back in a moment to why that is. And of course, the trace route deliberately varies some of this information. In the case of trace route with UDP, the port number increases with each packet that you send out. And it's done so that you can, it's an easy way of matching a TTL expired packet that comes back because you get the first bytes of the packet that expired. You get them back in the TTL expired message. And you can look at the port number that you send in there and say, oh, well, that's that one. cancer is likely to be working on, and Cybertracer is actually particularly likely to suffer from Genex Packer's signal for directions by the load balancer. So what Paratracer tries to do is it tries to discover where there are load balancers in the path. It doesn't try to deal with random load balancers. It just uses that statistically. It says, well, you know, tell me what percentage of probability you want to know whether you found that or not, and I'll just send enough packets to figure that out. It doesn't deal with destination based load balancers. In the paper, they kind of say they've kind of waved that away because they say, well, it's just a special case of flow based, which it is, of course, but in reality, it's not actually a technique that can discover destination based load balancer. But it does deal with flow ID load balancing. So the trick that they do is that they create headers so that the flow ID remains the same over a whole trace route. And they can do that for UDP-based trace route, for SMP, and for TCP-based trace route. UDP-based trace route, they vary the checksum so that the whole header stays the same in total. So the flow ID at the end of it stays the same because they vary both the checksum and manipulated the payload to make the checksum match. For ICMP, they vary the sequence number and the identifier. So that the checksum remains constant because that's included in the packet and the flow-based stuff. Sorry, let me back up and explain this very clearly. The problem they need to solve is how do they identify, if they keep the whole flow of ID the same, how do they distinguish the replies to different packets they send? So for UDP, they do that by deliberately setting the checksum to some value, which they then can recognize when the packet comes back. And to do that, they need to modify the payload to make a match checksum, otherwise the thing would be dropped. For ICMP, they vary the sequence number and the identifier, but they must make sure that the checksum remains the same, because the checksum is often included in these load balances. The reason why it's included, it's a little hard to see here, is probably just laziness. If you want to include the source and destination port from a UDP or a TCP packet, that's exactly the same path in the packet. If it's an ICMP one, well, that actually has a type and the code and the checksum in it. And that's why they end up including the checksum. The type doesn't change in any packets they send, so they don't really sort of say that it's included, although logically it is. And for TCMP, they've just varied the sequence number because that's not included in the use of sort of hard open technique. So what do they find for their set of 5,000 destinations from the university? They found that 5.3% of trace route paths had loops in them. So they look like this, and they appeared to look like that as far as trace route presented them. And 87%, majority of them, were caused by per flow load balancing. They found cycles in some, they were much less common, but when they did find cycles, they were mostly also caused by per flow load balancing. And diamonds, they found, again, a lot of those, and most of them were caused by per flow load balancing. So that's the end of those. This particular talk. Do you want to take questions? I mean, I can ask and answer any questions, but I'm not sure.
Are there questions that people ask about this? Thank you.
So you think that's asking the University of Washington? You might have mentioned something to this about this earlier, but I've forgotten. So I think DoubleTree sort of starts from this assumption that you can send all the probes and you're mostly trying to reduce overhead. And so I was curious how, if you thought at all about how that applies in your setting when you have 100,000 probes and
like signing 100,000 probes, you'll hit, you'll either pass complaints or hit regularly on SMP replies. So I'm wondering if you've thought at all about, like, is there some pre-processing step before you get to the double key part where you decide, which programs you're going to use into the double tree algorithm, and how does that end up, then does double tree not have to scale at 100,000? I don't know, I'm just wondering if you thought about it.
Yeah, I certainly thought about it, and I don't know the answers yet. That's unfortunate. I really hope to have them. I have at least some answers for you by the day, but didn't get that far. The key problem with probing from a lot of destinations to a few sources is it's overwhelming the links close to the destination, right? It doesn't matter quite as much further back in the network that you're sending lots of probes, because they all come in from different places and they just traffic that gets carried. But the closer you get to the destination, the more of those probes are going to end up on the same link. And as you say, this thing that we had at the end here might be just a small machine on somebody's DSL connection, and so we just can't do that. At one level, at least, it appears that double tree could be extremely effective in reducing that, because the first tracer, it goes all the way and finds this, and the next one that comes along doesn't have to go to that last link. And the more that you send, the further back in the network you learn information, and so the later probes go less and less distance. Now, the side of this problem is that somehow you've got to communicate this information between the probes, and that has a cost associated with it. In terms of pre-filtering, well, probably you're not going to ask, you're probably unlikely to initially, anyway, ask every probe to test to one destination. You might, for example, say, well, we'll take one per autonomous system, to go further than that, it seems a bit tricky as to how you would actually filter it out to a smaller number other than perhaps randomly. Does that answer your question?
Thanks. I'm curious to see once you move from the simulations into starting to send more probes and see what happens.
Yeah, I'll give you a hint to call. Thanks for the question.
Okay, thank you. So we've got another presentation. We're going to do a second presentation. We'll try and get Andre to speak again. And we'll have a final presentation from Casey at Kenya. So. Okay, so I want to tell you a little bit more about this design, this thought experiment at this stage that we carry on to think about. Could you build something with, say, in the order of 100,000 probes? Why would you want to do it? What might it do for you, those kinds of things? And as I mentioned at the beginning, I'm not really part of RIPE. In this context, I'm not really part of the University of Waikato either, so I kind of keep displaying everybody. it's a bit like being a Guantanamo Bay, I think, but in a good way, rather than a bad way. I come under any jurisdiction. So there are a whole bunch of challenges in active measure. I want to start by trying to motivate why you want to do this. Why is this an important problem? And I'll start by talking quite broadly about problems in active measurement. That wouldn't solve all of these, but it does address some of them. Basically, at the moment, if you're doing from an analog style topology measurement, and then I'll move on to some other examples, if you're doing topology measurement, you can do it from a small number, say a few hundreds of sources, and then you can measure out if you want to do large numbers of destinations, and you don't have to always have control of the destinations that you measure to, and this is what Scamper does. From Planet Lab, people have done various experiments, including Ethan with Hubble. There's some problems with this. Firstly, the limited perspectives is the obvious thing. You don't see from everywhere. machines and the internet era. Many of them are academic sites, which are often connected by research and education networks. They generally have fairly large networks, and are generally well connected, even if they're not. If your product isn't hosted at a university, it might well be hosted by an ISP, and again, well connected. When you are probing, you need to probe to some destination, but you don't have control of that destination, so you don't actually know what's happening there. So if you can't reach it at the moment, it may be because there's never been a machine there, because the machine at the moment is down, or because part of the network path to it is missing. The network is asymmetric, but you're only likely to discover the directions from your probes out to the destination. So if you wanted to, like I am for double tree, you wanted to sort of build a map of a network so that you can then poke your packets in and see how they perform. You only get half of the topology, you only get the outgoing stuff, and you've got to sort of assume that coming back is likely to be the same, even though we know it's not symmetric. For some interference, it probably doesn't matter, others it will. Because of the small number of probes, the cycle time is high, and typically you can't get behind that because the machines are, they won't accept just incoming traffic from them. Another example is the sort of area that Ethan has been working in with discovering routing failures. And you can discover the failures that are seen by the perspectives that you have, but that doesn't necessarily mean you discover them all. You probably won't. In the little picture down here, okay, we've got a source that this case is going to two destinations, and it can measure up to H, and it can measure to the other H here. But the two H's talk to one another through a different path, and you never saw this one. And so if it's broken, you've got no way of knowing. If you have a failure close to one of the monitors, then you can't see anything beyond that, and so you potentially miss a lot of failures that way. So the accurate diagnosis of precisely where the failure happens is challenging. The direction of failure is difficult. As Ethan's talked about a couple of days ago, you can get quite a long way by using spoofing, but spoofing has quite a lot of limitations to it, so that doesn't discover everything. And in many cases, you can't spoof it. It's quite likely that over time, spoofing will become less and less effective as people build stronger and stronger filters. It's difficult to discover the extent of the failure, and as I mentioned, you can't see pathway symmetries. So the big kind of issues here, I think, are limited perspectives. But at the moment, you might get 0.01% of end hosts as sources. It's just a tiny fraction of the network. You could get a bit better if you're just interested in autonomous systems, but these numbers are very ballpark. I'm just trying to give you an idea of the scale that we're looking at. You might get 0.2% of autonomous systems as sources. So you miss a lot of things. You can probe to third-party destinations, but you don't know about the responsiveness. You don't know what the workload is going on that machine or on the last link, and so forth. So that introduces a lot of unbalance into your measurement. And, of course, you can't get behind NATs. So, what is this bar thing? It's really a question, as I said before, a thought experiment. Could we design and build, maintain, and make good use of an active measurement system that had in the order of 100,000 probes? If we could, what might it look like? And what are the key challenges in doing that? So, just to focus a wee bit more on the problem, I've got an example application. Again, it's the Hubble-like application. What we want is a notification service that would tell you about reachability events that happen preemptively. So it's going to find this out and automatically send you some information that you've got some reachability problems. The large-scale example is likely you should hijack. in some way, and that failure is specific to people of number. It's not total failure, only some people can not reach new destinations. So we can find out quite a lot about this by from current data, like there is data points, PGP tables, but it's much useful after the event, partly because of the way it's able to be collected, but more so because you don't know what to look for until the event has happened. The YouTube event, you know, it's very clear, and you can see them, particularly playing like movies and so forth. But it's not obvious that you could pick that up beforehand from routing information. You know, because changes in the network are quite common, even quite large scale changes sometimes. The goal is to produce something Hubble-like, but with a wide range of vantage points, including non-academic sites and a lot more leaf nodes and just a larger number of explanations. There are lots of other things that you might do with this kind of system as well, including bidirectional topology and so forth. So I'm running out of time, so I need to just speed up a little. So what are the pros and what makes you get this? What's the thing going to look like? Well, it's obviously going to be hierarchical. If we had hundreds of thousands of probes, you're not going to sort of, 100,000 probes, you're not going to just sort of connect them up to one management system and have it look after them all. So probes are likely to be, so this hierarchy is a starting point. It's a stick in the sand saying, or a line in the sand saying, okay, what's it likely to be like? So it's likely to be hierarchical. Probes are likely to be clustered together into controllers. And then, controllers look after their probes. They know something about the resources that the probe has, etc. And then the controllers are managed by brains, and of which there's probably a relatively small number, and possibly a super brain that sort of oversees the whole thing. As you go sort of down the model, the number of components increases. Information flows upwards. The probes are doing the actual measurements. They go up to the controller in turn may aggregate some of that information and then pass it up to the brain and so forth up to the super brain. So the probes themselves, they like to be either hardware or software. If they're hardware, because we're going to have want to deploy a lot of things, they're going to have to be cheap. And fortunately, there are a lot of systems out there which are now relatively capable and cheap. They can be the sort of single board computer type systems, but hard to see the scale. This is a sort of slightly larger than a cigarette packet type machine. So I'm even, and it's very hard to see this picture, I'm sorry, even existing just like an Ethernet port type thing. So you probably want something like a few hundred megahertz of processor, some flash and some RAM, and an Ethernet port on it. We also think that there should be the possibility of software-only probes that are deployed on an existing machine. They'll likely to change more often than the hardware probes, and they'll likely have different performance characteristics. So how might this thing look as an overall architecture? Again, I need to emphasize this is very fluid. At the moment, my thinking is along this sort of line that the hierarchy that we just described is here with, one super brain, a relatively small number of brains, say less than 16, and then some controllers that are controlling individual probes, so say less than 100 controllers per brain and 1,000 probes per controller. When a probe comes to life, it needs to have some way of figuring out what controller it should talk to and where to find that controller. And that's managed by a registration server. So the probe goes to a well-known address of some sort and asks that address or set of addresses, I'm a probe, who should I talk to for my controller? And then the registration server can give one more controllers for it to talk to. And the probe can then pick between the possibilities. And a similar sort of process happens when controllers and brains come to life as well. The data itself will need to be stored somewhere and presented to users through perhaps a web server or some other kind of service, and that happens on this presentation server, which can also be responsible for requesting for getting new requests and measurements, which then get given to the super brain or the brains. Okay, so I've kind of talked about the probes already. They can be tokens of software. They perform the low-level measurements, things like payment trace routes, send a packet. On a boot request, they find a controller through the registration server. The software obviously needs to be remotely upgradable, and the resources, probably the most important point, the resources will be limited. That may be because of the hardware, or it may be because the user who's deployed the product only wants to give you a certain amount of resource. In terms of stability, the probes aren't expected to be highly stable. They'll be coming and going. In fact, it's expected that the set of probes that's available will always be in flux with that large number of probes. The controller manages a set of probes. It keeps track of what probes it has available, and it can answer questions about what resources each probe has. Things like, where is the probe located? What IP does it have? That's what optimum system it's in. How much bandwidth does it have available at the moment? How much memory has it got for storing results? And the controller can accept work requests from the brain and then aggregate perhaps the results. So, with a Hubble-type system, for example, you might not be terribly interested in positive reachability events, and so you might just aggregate those up to a statistic. But non-reachability events, you may pass up all of those, and the controller can take account of that. It's got medium reliability, it shouldn't go down, but if it does, then the operation of all the other controllers and the rest of the thing, system should just continue on with that problem. The brain manages a set of controllers and, in some sense, it implements a measurement application. And so, one measurement application may involve lots of low-level tests, and the brain is keeping control of this. It knows or can discover what resources each of its controllers have, and it can then allocate work to the controllers. The brain really has to be pretty reliable. If it fails in the particular measurement that it's looking after, will fail. If there is a super brain, it has some overall supervision of the brains, and it can be involved in allocating work between the brains to keep an even load between them, and also discovering resources that only some brains may have. And if you want a particular autonomous system, for example, to be part of your measurement, it may only be available through one controller, through one brain, and so the super brain can find that out for you and help you to allocate the measurement to an appropriate set of brains. There's only ever going to be one of these, and it should be hardened against failure, although if it fails, that shouldn't stop the rest of the system, so the brains themselves can continue on, and the existing measurements that are happening will all continue on. You just might not be able to start perhaps a new one. Presentation server, as I said, it interfaces with users, it presents data, there might be multiple servers of these just to provide enough resource and stability. Registration server is very simple. The main thing that it has is it knows where the existing resources are, and when a new resource, like a new probe, comes along, it just sends a message to the registration server and it replies with where to find the next level in the hierarchy. So the major challenge that we face is this one, in fact, that we mentioned in the last talk, is it's not obvious how you design measurements that have a very large number of probes. You can't, for example, do full mesh probing, probably. If you've got 100,000 probes, you're pinging to another 100,000, to all the other 700,000 probes. It's going to be too much capacity for many of the kinds of links that users are going to be prepared, some users are going to be prepared to give you. So we're looking at optimized techniques, and one of them is to use trace route, as I mentioned, and that's the focus of the work we do.
happening at the moment. I think I'll leave it there since I'm at the end of my time.
Message is defeated, so we're going to try to get by a phone. And okay.
because Daniel, you're on one thing. Okay, this is work. That doesn't work. Sorry about that, so we're going to have to just go on this talk, especially for the next meeting. We do have a further presentation we might have to from Casey from Kenneth, so
Tuesday for real, but I haven't been around much this week, so I'm here kind of finally. So I'm going to give a brief update on what CADA's been doing in active measurement. How many people have heard of ARC? CADA's ARC project. Five people in the room. How many people have heard of SCIDA? Okay. Well, we've got twice as many people. So SCIDA was our 10-year running, more or less, trace route project, kind of a little bit smarter than trace route, but not much more. Through about 30 machines originally around the world, and they were probing over a million different IP addresses. In the first version of this project, which we call SCIDA overloading, to mean a lot of different things, not just the project, but the infrastructure, the software, the hardware, the data, the maps. In the first version of the project, we were trying to limit ourselves to IP addresses that would not theoretically be in a position to object to a probe, because we were worried about setting up pagers and not sending people, and this was actually back in the early 90s, mid-90s, so there wasn't a whole lot of attention to this yet. But we, as such, we limited our addressing list, our destination list, to web servers or data servers or some IP addresses that we found another way we're on the internet supposedly providing services, and therefore should object to a ping packet or a ICMP packet or two. In this version of this active measurement project, we changed quite a few things, and that's one of the big things we changed is the way that we pick destination groups. So instead of trying to go out of our way to make sure we have a live, active, current list of responding destinations, which is impossible to keep current, and we tried to keep it current for a couple of years, and then we eventually just let the list go. We didn't add anything to it. We didn't take away except when IP addresses stopped responding, which happens on a regular basis. I think it was 10%. I can't remember if it was a month or a year, but it's just a systematic destination of any given destination IP list that you have that you're trying to probe on the internet. As things disappear behind firewalls, stop responding, go off the net, what have you. So the current version or instantiation of our active measurement project, which we are calling, we're calling the platform ARC, Archipelago, ARC for short, we're choosing a different approach to gathering destinations. Okay, good. So this is a long slide set that will give you the sort of detail on update of this project, and I won't go through all of it because it's too long for here. I'll go through it quickly. Each of these slides may point to different aspects of the project that you may want to investigate more carefully, or I can answer questions on it at the end. But just to give you some high-level motivation of what we're trying to do and how far we've gotten so far. Next-generation active measurement infrastructure after SPIDR, we call it full production as of September 12, 2007, although we're still adding between one and two boxes per month. This is currently being funded by U.S. government agencies, two of the National Science Foundation and the Department of Homeland Security. What is the focus? So what are we trying to do in ARC that we didn't do in SPIDR? Well, for one thing, SPIDR did one thing. SPIDR did trace route, and it actually did it fairly stupidly. It didn't use double trace, it didn't use pairs, it just sent out, didn't try to figure out that it had already probed stuff and not probed again. It didn't divide up work into multiple teams so that you could do things in parallel, and just every box sent the same tracer out to every destination. So what we're trying to do with ARC is enable a lot of different types of measurements besides just topology measurements. Although even topology measurement is a whole host of things you can do there that isn't just about getting the path per se, but getting annotations about the path, including bandwidth and latency and data semantics, customer semantics. So what we're trying to do with ARC is enable not only topology measurements, all different types of measurements, and really build a platform, think of it as kind of an operating system for measurement itself. So that if a researcher comes along, a scientist comes along, wants to do an experiment on the global internet, or at least a big serious chunk of the macroscopic internet, they can bring that experiment to ARC and not have to worry about building an actual platform to do it, which in our own painful experience, we learn, takes up most of the time and you don't end up having much time left to do the actual research. So that's what we're trying to do, lower the barrier for other researchers, including ourselves, to participate in that measurement, broad scale measurement. And we're in the process of doing this. I mean, our approach to doing this is to raise a level of abstraction by providing scripting languages and APIs for people who don't necessarily want to learn about the low-level details of measurement infrastructure. So we, if it wasn't obvious, we took a lot of inspiration from other projects that have tried to do little pieces of this, and we're essentially trying to put them all together into a global system. So what is the architectural glue that allows this to happen? Well, one, we have, instead of each node essentially acting on its own, we have each ARC node is part of this coordinated facility, and therefore you can take advantage of distributed measurement nodes in ways that you couldn't do with SPIDR. That is, you can set up teams to focus on a certain measurement assignment that you want them to do, and another team can focus on something else, or you can just divide up that destination list into subsets and divide it proper, as it were. And you can see double keys below. Okay. Build on the work of others. Composed of measurement nodes located in various networks worldwide. Thank you very much for hosting in our box, because we have almost half of them are in Europe, actually. And many of these were people that were hosting SPIDR boxes, or some, very few, but a couple of the old NLAM or PMA boxes we turned into ARC boxes when NLAM went away. Please contact if you want to host an ARC box, obviously. And we use something called a couple space, which sort of architecture. distributed shared memory combined with, again, this easy-to-use API to essentially request a measurement from the system by speaking a high-level language. It's written in Ruby. Now, Hume is the designer and implementer of this, and he's totally in love with Ruby. If you're a Ruby fan, definitely contact him. Okay, so here's just a schematic of monitors that are out there. A central server located in India, which brings data back, but the monitors can act independently. We just provide some centralization for bringing data back to analyze it. For the monitors, we currently have about 33. That might be a little bit higher because these slides are 2 months old, but actually I don't think it is much higher. It might be 35 across 22 countries, and here's a little schematic. There's a Google app. You can go to the website and find out where that nodes are now. We try to keep it up to date. And what are the kinds of measurements that we're doing today? Six different big headings here. The top one we call IPv4 /enforceology. This is essentially the original type of trace route that we were doing with Skidder. The reason we call it this now is that whereas Skidder, I mentioned earlier, we try to make sure we have an IP list that is pre-embedded to be responding. And this, when we're doing this topology measurement with ARC, we don't do that. We just put one IP address in each /24 of the entire IPv4 router space. Router space, so not the whole IPv4 space. So we take route views, or write, but I think we use route views right now, and we chunk that up into every announced prefix, and we chunk that up into 24, is every one IP from every 24, and it's dynamic. So every new polling cycle, we pick a new randomly selected IP within each route of 24, and then the data set that we end up making available, well, one of several data sets we end up making available is the results of this probing from one of many of our ARC monitors to each /24. I'll go through the rest of these I have a slide on each of these, at least one slide, but the second one is convert the IP addresses into ASs using PGP routing tables. We sort of have done this for years now, so it should be new to most folks in here. So convert to AS links from IP links to AS links using PGP routing tables. There's obviously some heuristics in there as we move most of these steps. Number three is IPv6 topology, so we never did this before because we didn't have IPv6 capable monitors, so we still don't have many IPv6 capable monitors. We have about 6 out of 33. But we did do a map this year, and I have copies of it somewhere looking for you on the IPv6 topology as we're able to observe it. You might be thinking in your mind, how are you picking your destination list with IPv6 because you can't possibly use the same approach that you used in IPv4. That's true. So we do something more brute force, which is we go download from the registries where they've allocated IPv6 addresses, and we just pick one randomly inside the beginning of the IPv6 prefix that's been allocated. Not as thorough, not as maybe bulletproof of methodology, but that's what we've got right now. And then DNS, there's two DNS data sets. One is for every IP address that we probe in the course of this trace route, like probing that we do, we resolve it to a DNS name, and then we store any DNS names that resolve. Not just the probed, ultimate probe destination, but every intermediate hop that we find along the way that resolves to a DNS name, we store it in this list and make that list available to people. And then the fifth one down, DNS free response, means in the process of getting that resolution, when we do a reverse lookup, we find name servers that then send us to the authoritative place for that lookup, and we store the entire transaction, the entire TCPIP transaction from one DNS server to the other until we get the authoritative resolution for this IP address. And if folks are interested, they can get that data too. And then the last thing I'll mention is this Spoofer project, which is kind of the thing I'm most excited about right now, so I'll spend a whole song on it. I'm going backwards with this baseball. Okay. An example of IPv4 routed /24 topology. I mentioned earlier what it was. I should make a big shout out to Waikato, since Tony McGregor, who was just speaking, was the advisor for Matthew Buckley, who wrote the code that is essentially the fundamental probing code for the topology project. Now, we're trying to separate, I should have said this at the beginning, but we're trying to separate, that's perfect, the infrastructure that's supporting different types of measurements, including topology, but not limited to topology measurements. Or even conceivably be doing passive measurements if you wanted to go that way, which we haven't, but it's not out of the question. So we're trying to separate the infrastructure, the platform, the operating system for doing the measurements, separated from the measurements itself. So the platform is ARC. We call that ARC developer, or ARC for short, and the nodes in ARC are ARC nodes, and again, they can be actually a result of us doing a thorough experiment on which of the tip different probing methods, ICMP, ICMP Paris, UDP, UDP Paris, TCP, we're going to capture as the most topology information possible. Last year, we submitted that as an IMC paper. And I think that might have also been part of Matthew's thesis. And so then we, the result, the answer was ICMP Paris, and so that's what we're now using operationally. As I mentioned earlier, we did group the monitors into teams, divided the measurement among various teams. Looks like right now we have three teams active. And this is a schematic from September 07 to March of 09 when we last presented this of how much trace route data we got. And we'll get this in a second. So there's 2.5 million trace routes represented there. Those are the ARC monitors on the right. So the vertical bars there where you see gaps in the data is software failure. The horizontal bars where you see much longer gaps in the data are hardware failure. This one horizontal bar where you saw a gap and then a little green, meaning real data again, is a power supply died, and we put one back finally and it died immediately, so it wasn't really the power supply. So you can see real problems going on in the data here. And then as I mentioned earlier, the next data set really just maps the IP addresses to AS using round views. We also compare this to other topology data that's out there, the dimes and the graphics, which is BGP data. So we only compare this to dimes in this data set. I don't think we did iPlane, although I think somebody did iPlane at Ames. Ethan maybe will comment on that. And then we just give you some basic statistics of the data set. So these statistics are going to map them later, like average degree and average neighbor degree and clustering. As we try to decide things like, here's a big one. The appropriate window to use when you're trying to build a map of the internet. Do you want 2 weeks of topology data? Do you want 6 weeks of topology data? And the reason this matters is this is a very unfortunate thing that happens that even the best scientists out there, at least they're not talking about it if they didn't figure this out, which is there seems to be an accumulation of links that you get if you just probe just even the same or a variety or changing list of IP addresses. You seem to have a continual accumulation of links between ASs. And you may, in the back of your head, think, well, in a sense, there's a lot of backup connectivity in the internet. You may see one link one day and one link the other day. That's true, and that may completely explain it, but this seems to be happening no matter how you look at the data, no matter over what interval of time you seem sort of, it never levels off. And so one of the things we're trying to figure out, what is the right level of the window, which is stop and say, okay, I have 2 weeks of data, this is my map of the internet that I'm going to use today. And these three statistics on the right are kind of how we compare different intervals to figure out at what point does mean clustering change. And you've got kind of a mean in the curve based on the window in which you're observing things. So this is now weighing into topology research and trying to figure out how to get the best map. So this is accumulating all three different AS link sources. The top two, dimes and ARC, meaning trace route converting to AS, trace route data converting to AS using BGP data. And the bottom one is just using BGP data straight. And it's 1 month accumulation of both cases. That was CCDF of no degree, cumulative distribution function of no degree, complementary cumulative distribution function. And the next one is average neighbor degree. So this means if you're the no degree of a given node in the observed data set is on the x-axis, and the y-axis is for that node, for nodes of that degree, on the x, what is the average degree of the nodes and neighbors on the y? So this does turn out to matter in terms of the correlation of degrees with their neighbors, which is a big way of modeling and reproducing data sets with similar characteristics to another. So if you want to do a simulation of something that's internet-like, the degree correlations between a node and its neighbors matters a lot. You want to reproduce that as well if you can. So that's why this is up here. And this is clustering, the third, the last metric in the table. You don't see a lot of convergence here, so this is why, again, sort of topology, there's still mysteries that are unresolved and why there's a lot of different clustering values here. And this is what I mentioned earlier. There seems to be a linear accumulation of AS links, no matter how you look at it, even with fixed trace route sources and destination lists. And you can see some, and the average degree of the graph, which we call densification, also degree seems to increase. No matter how long you look at it. Okay, so I'm 5 minutes. I want to kind of get to this spoofer thing. So I'll skip that. This is how you determine the natural time period. I mentioned that before. I don't even know what the punchline is here. I will be. Does anybody have spam on how to increase the size of your beta stuff? One of my young up spam. So we put it in the last one. Okay, and this is just showing again the fact that the links seem to accumulate without bound, even as nodes give some indication of leveling off. So I'm just going to go through that really quickly because I want to spend a couple of time on. If you're interested in this mystery, come talk to me offline. I can give you a PhD thesis to do, not to read to do. V6 topology I mentioned earlier. Hubert said we have three V6 nodes in the U.S. and three in Europe. I think that's probably still true. I think we've been using our seventh one in the last 3 months. And again, we're doing a pair of star starts in every routed prefix that we can find. It sounds to me because of the routing here, we're using the route gives V6 data instead of or in addition to the registry assignments. And this is some stats we get on V6 topology from December of last year to February of this year, right before the workshop that we had. And again, this is comparing V6 to V4. I don't really think there's much to see in here scientifically because I don't think there's enough V6 data to make it statistically significant. So you can see that big drop in the middle, which if that were a lot of data, you'd be like, oh, well, this is a fundamentally different graph, but it's not a lot of data, so you can't make those claims. So I'm going to skip these. Okay, TNS names I mentioned. Using an in-house lookup service that they can do millions of addresses per day. This is probably out of date now, but we had 200 million lookups since last year. That was March of 08 to February 9. And I mentioned the TCP now, so I'm going to skip that. AOS resolution is a big ongoing research project, meaning how do you figure out if you have a million IP addresses that you've gotten by TraceRoute, how do you figure out which one of those are the same router? I mean, even figuring out which one of those are the same AS is tricky. Figuring out which one of those are the same router is tricky in a different way, so it doesn't even help if you figure out which ones are in the same AS or vice versa. So we are working on a paper that will be finished Monday, I hope. And so I'm not going to talk about it now, but we can talk about it at the next meeting on how we're collapsing interfaces of Dirk and Trace right into single routers. And the punchline is we're using a lot of different techniques that other people have done. We're trying to integrate them similar to the ARC project itself. Trying to integrate them to get the best possible data on this. Stay tuned. Spoofer. So Spoofer is really my favorite thing that ARC is doing right now. Has anyone heard of the Spoofer project at MIT? Rob Beverly? Okay, as many people have heard of ARC. Probably the same people. So Spoofer is using ARC, so that's good. Spoofer is a project that Rob Beverly did when he was a graduate student at MIT to try to figure out how much spoofing is allowed on the internet. That's a pretty tough question to answer unless you're really going to have a node in each AS on the internet, or maybe even each prefix, depending on what kind of granularity you're testing. But you tried it anyway without a node on each AS in the internet, but by using Flashdot instead, so that you tried to get everybody in the internet in a different AS. Download a client software that would then probe MIT with various types of addresses, including spoofed addresses. And if it got to MIT with a spoofed address, then he checked you off as your network is even spoofed. And he put out a slash that, let a few thousand people download the software, and then posted pie charts of what percent of AS is allowed spoofing, or what percent of networks, what percent of IP addresses. And then he extrapolated from what percent of AS that he got numbers from at all to what it would be if he assumed that was the same level of spoofing in the whole internet. The problem there is, well, the problems there are many, but one of them is that you're only testing one path to MIT from a given AS. Two is that you've got the slash dot bias, which means people who download your tool are going to bias the results toward whatever that population might be. And so we're trying to address some of that. Actually, I know that Wright thinks about DTM stuff in general, and we don't have a group like this per se, and the US maybe Kate is the closest thing to it, but this is a great application for an increasingly relevant and interesting to governments application for active measurement and broad scale macroscopic active measurement is network hygiene. So what ARC enables Spoofer to do is instead of Rob asking this client software to spoof to MIT, we're allowing him the ARC node by permission. In fact, if you run an ARC node, you got a letter asking if this is okay to do with your ARC node, because although the ARC nodes themselves are not engaging in spoofing, which would freak everybody out, right? And so we're careful about that. The ARC nodes in this experiment are receiving the spoofed packets that MIT used to receive. So that now, instead of one path, you can test from whatever AS has downloaded the code to all of the ARC nodes. And that's only 33 right now, but we're prototyping the idea that you could scale this up so that you could probe a lot more topology and get a lot more information. is if you had a new IPv4 address or an old IPv4 address, it would be nice to figure out who's using that address or who's filtering that address. Is it still on a mobile address? And therefore, it's not going to be as useful as another IP address. So this issue of filtering and understanding network hygiene, I think, is a brilliant application of vacuum measurements and underutilized. So again, that works in progress. Again, IMC paper this week, one of the reasons I haven't been here besides planning next year, I was working on these IMC papers. So hopefully there'll be good technical results to show you by next week, but the next time I'll be doing it is a couple months from now. And that's all I got. Yeah. Oh, last thing is that, and I think KTF really knows this, is that in order to, well, both for our own identification and in order to incent folks to deploy these nodes, so TKM probably has similar, I think TKM has similar front of the web page. So if you deploy a node, you get these nice views of what statistics your node can see on the internet, RTT, hotspot, CCDF, path length, etc. So if you go to this website, you'll see examples of these from every ARC node, and you're still in the process of building kind of aggregate statistics as seen from all of the ARC nodes. Okay. So far, I would lean toward that you're right. Because even in our early results on this paper, it's that 90% of the spoofing, or that is 80% of the spoofing happens one hop on the filter. And certainly within the same AS, 85-90% happens within the same AS. So it may be, you may be right, it may be not necessary, but it's something we need to measure to test. Script out, you mean the instantiation of script out on Planet Lab?
Yeah.
I have no idea. So one of the motivations for us moving this work in script out was a lot of great stuff, and Neil Spring, a fellow from the University of Maryland, was at University of Washington with him on a premium when he wrote script out and deployed it on Planet Lab, and it was doing to a piece of this, to do abstraction, to enable people to write simple scripts for doing measurement, and then use Planet Lab as kind of the platform to deploy them. And the problems that we heard whenever we saw try to have students work with Planet Lab was problems with the nodes itself, problems with, you know, getting access to a timestamp, or the share whole issue of shared facilities. So it made me that ScriptDrive just didn't have a safe platform to grow itself, you know, and I think Neil probably had a bunch of other things to do, so I can't say one way or the other what happened to ScriptDrive.
That's what it is. My next question is, what are you going to talk about the ScriptDrive version of ARC on so that people who want this abstraction can get more nodes?
Yeah, I would love it if someone did that. We just don't have the bodies for it. So, yeah, we're funded under a contract now to do this. So U.S. funding has shifted in the last few years, and they changed it back with Obama and power. But so we're trying to do some very specific stuff to get topology data on macroscopic internet for situational awareness, infrastructure protection type stuff, which means I don't have as much resources to spend on Planet Lab. But I would love it. In fact, I should have spent some more time on this future work slide, but one of the things I'm going to do is try to make this code available to anybody who wants to deploy their own ARC infrastructure. And I would love to see other people use it if it were useful. And, you know, it may be the case that there are things that you find that are useful out of this that you want to deploy into a different type of architecture, just like we did with ScriptDrive. But in any event, the tuple space itself for doing the coordination communication between nodes should be available this year by GPL. Hopefully you'll build one.
I think that's all we've got time for, actually, but thanks very much. We do have one more for generosity. Do you want any other business? Is there anybody else to raise? Okay. Well, it remains me to thank all our speakers, Casey, Tony, and thank you for taking this look for our audio engineers. I'll see you all in.